February 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump supports additional checks on gun purchasers. Israel and Iran clash at the Munich Security Conference over the nuclear threat, and the Spice Girls plan to go on tour. It's all ahead. The White House said Monday President Donald Trump is supporting efforts to tighten federal background checks on gun buyers in the aftermath of last week's shooting massacre of 17 people at a Florida high school. The measure would not impose new restrictions on gun purchases, but rather attempt to make sure that information about mental health and criminal conviction records that legally bar individuals from buying weapons is consistently sent to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. VOA's Bill Gallo tells me Trump's new support of these checks marks a change in the president's views on guns.
It is somewhat of a change. I mean, Trump has a complicated history when it comes to gun control. In the past, he has been a little less, all about gun rights than he is now. But since he really entered the political scene, he's really gone to the right on that issue. And this reflects a change, I guess, from that stance. But yes, he says he's open to background checks. There's a bipartisan bill that's being floated around. Let's see if it actually, if they follow through with that. There's a lot of talk after every mass shooting, on bipartisan bills to, enact gun control measures. And there's often very little action and follow through.
Yeah, now apparently this current Senate legislation, it involves a Republican, Senator John Cornyn, as well as Democratic Senator Chris Murphy. So the fact that it's bipartisan, in a way, that seems like it certainly would reach out to both parties. What is the status of that bill at the moment?
Well, it's really in the early stages as far as that bill is concerned. But the interesting thing to me is that Donald Trump really has a big decision to make here. This is an issue that's getting a lot of attention right now in the media. These children that are actually speaking up, the victims, that some of their friends died, they're speaking out on cable television. They're putting a lot of pressure on him right now. But it's unclear whether he will actually change his mind. I mean, this is a guy who knows instinctually that his base cares about this issue. And Donald Trump appeals to his base. His approval rating is not very high. He has to appeal to his base in order to protect his approval rating. So, does he have any space to actually make a move here? I don't know if he does.
And apparently some of those students from that school intend to have a rally here in Washington next month to call for action on gun control.
Right, which suggests maybe this will be a topic that will be in the news for some time and that it won't go away. They are having a rally here. Also, this week, the White House has said that President Trump will hold a listening session with some students. They haven't specified which students. I don't know if it will actually be the students of that Florida school that will talk with Trump. But this is definitely an issue right now, and it looks like it will be for at least the near future.
And President Trump also was very critical of the FBI on Twitter, saying that they had misleads regarding the suspect in the Parkland shooting. He even accused the FBI of spending too much time investigating, Russia and Russia's possible link to his own 2016 presidential campaign.
Right. Now, that's very much in line with the way Donald Trump has talked about the FBI in the past. It's important to note, though, that the activities of the FBI as it relates to this school shooting, that would be done out of the Miami field office. That has very little to do with the work of the counterintelligence division, unless you need it to be related for political purposes, which I think is being done here. So it's not really clear there's a link there, but Trump is attempting to draw that link.
VOA's Bill Gallo. Time now for social media. Well, today is President's Day here in the United States. It's commemorated annually near the February birthdays of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Bradley Scott tweets, "Happy birthday, George Washington. After 8 years of Obama putting America last, it feels great to celebrate a couple of presidents who put America first. God bless. At mention, real Donald Trump, and God bless America." But Amy Kent tweets, "Today we celebrate presidents. I choose to celebrate ex-presidents, as the one we have now is not worthy of that title or honor. #PresidentsDay2018. And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. South Africa's opposition slams the new president following his maiden speech. A Trump press pool driver is detained for having a firearm. After U.S. indictments, Russia denies any election meddling, that the election in 2016, that is, and a volcano erupts in Indonesia, no fatalities or injuries reported. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
Thanks to data from NASA's K2 mission, an international team of scientists led by Andrew Mayo of the National Space Institute at the Technical University of Denmark have recently discovered 95 more exoplanets. Sifting through a list of some 275 candidates, the researchers were able to validate 149 of them as actual exoplanets. According to the research team, it turns out that 95 of these planets are actually new exoplanet discoveries. The K2 mission was developed by NASA after serious technical problems with the Kepler spacecraft in 2012 and 2013 threatened to end the original Kepler mission. So instead of giving up, NASA proposed a modification and extension of its mission, called it K2, which has been operating ever since. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a report in Australia says disadvantages remain for Indigenous people despite some progress. Iran's official IRNA news agency reported Monday that Iranian rescue teams have located the wreckage of a plane that crashed with 65 people on board. Officials fear all those on board were killed. The plane crashed soon after takeoff from a Tehran airport Sunday, bound for the southwest city of Yazoo. The plane disappeared from radar over mountainous terrain, and bad weather may have been a factor. The airplane was a French-built ATR-72, a twin-engine turboprop operated by Osman Airlines, a domestic carrier. Todd Curtis, founder of the website airsafe.com, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the aircraft had reportedly been out of service in storage for years before being returned to service.
This is an aircraft that's flown by this airline fairly regularly. They have a small fleet of these aircraft, and they ordered recently several dozen more. So this is not something that this airline was unfamiliar with, at least as far as how this aircraft operates. Now, it's the particulars of this particular event that remains to be seen, whether weather was an issue, whether it was something to do with maintenance, or whether there was some other issue that came up.
Todd, what can you tell us about the ATR-72?
The ATR-72, which is a variation of the ATR-42, a longer version of the ATR-42, these two models have been in wide use around the world for roughly a quarter century. And although it does have a record of major accidents, the last major crash involving the ATR-72 was about 3 years ago in Taiwan. And last December in Canada, there was a fatal crash involving the ATR-42 that killed one passenger. Now, that aside, although the aircraft has been involved in a number of fatal accidents over the years, there has been no ongoing issue, no ongoing controversy with anything about the design of the aircraft or fundamental faults with how the aircraft is handled by airlines.
Iran has blamed a lack of spare parts and Western sanctions for degrading, if you will, the safety of its domestic and international airlines. What is the Iranian aviation record so far?
Iran is a relatively small country compared to the United States or Great Britain, but it's also a country that has a very significant aviation sector. And in spite of the fact there have been sanctions, in spite of the fact there's been less than a full interchange between Iran and the rest of the world since their 79 revolution, they've kept up well with both their civil and military sector with respect to keeping their airlines up and flying, and also being cognizant of the procedures and the changes that have gone on in the world. But one of the things that is a fallout from having the sanctions in place over decades is that not only is it more difficult to buy new aircraft or get replacement parts, it's also more difficult to have the kind of formal and informal exchanges between aviation professionals that goes on around the world. Many of the things that happen over time in aviation is based on the fact that those professionals who dedicated their lives to making aviation safer and more efficient, they get a chance to meet each other at conferences. They get a chance to work in different companies over time. In Iran, that's not so easy to do.
That's Todd Curtis of WebSafe.com. This is the second airline crash in as many weeks. All 71 were killed on board an Antonov 148 twin-engine aircraft operated by Saratov Airlines shortly after takeoff February 11th from a Moscow airport. Iran and Israel have accused each other of aggression in the Middle East, with both sides warning of escalating dangers in the region. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference in Germany Sunday, Israel's prime minister warned Tehran would develop a nuclear bomb within a decade. As Henry Ridgewell reports from Munich, the growing threat of nuclear warfare has loomed over the three-day meeting.
Facing possible corruption charges back home, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took to the stage at the Munich Security Conference Sunday to deliver a stark warning.
The nuclear agreement with Iran has begun the countdown to an Iranian nuclear arsenal in little more than a decade.
Netanyahu brandished what he claimed was a piece of an Iranian drone shot down over Israel. He said Iran's aggression was changing regional alliances.
It's brought Arabs and Israelis closer together as never before. And in a paradoxical way, this may pave the way for a broader peace and ultimately also for a Palestinian-Israeli peace.
Just hours before Netanyahu spoke, Israel carried out a number of attacks on Palestinian positions in Gaza, killing two people. The strikes followed a bomb attack which wounded four Israeli soldiers. Speaking later Sunday in Munich, Iran's foreign minister dismissed the Israeli prime minister's speech as cartoonish.
Israel uses aggression as a policy against its neighbors. Mass reprisals against its neighbors, daily incursions into Syria, Lebanon, and other Arab countries.
Zarif said Tehran was seeking peace in the region based on mutual respect.
Iran believes that our security in the Persian Gulf requires a fresh regional security architecture.
The threat of nuclear war has loomed over the conference, as countries like North Korea seek atomic weapons, while established nuclear powers renew their arsenals. Nobel Peace Prize winner Beatrice Finn of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons told VOA the global community cannot continue on this path.
Nuclear weapons is definitely a big threat that is coming back, and I think it's, for me, it's really important to be here to remind all the governments that if we keep the current policies, there will be use of nuclear weapons. So we have to urgently move towards disarmament before that happens.
The conference has underlined the deep divides between rivals in the Middle East and in many other arenas. The hope here is that recognizing the perilous dangers the world faces is the first step in preventing major conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the Munich Security Conference, Germany.
Australia has made some progress in improving the lives of its indigenous people. That's according to an annual report. The government's Closing the Gap report tracks efforts to reduce inequality between indigenous and non-indigenous Australians. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian government says that its tracking of indigenous health and well-being has shown its most promising results since 2011, despite seeing improvement in only 3 out of 7 targets. Efforts to reduce child mortality rates are on target, as are 2 of 4 education standards. But inequality still exists in employment opportunities for Australian Aborigines. whose employment rate was just over 46% in 2016, compared with a nearly 72% rate for non-Indigenous Australians. Life expectancy for Aborigines is about 10 years less than non-Aboriginal Australians. Australia's original inhabitants remain the country's most disadvantaged group. They suffer disproportionately high rates of imprisonment, poverty, and ill health. 10 years ago this week, Indigenous Australians received a historic government apology for past injustices, including the removal of tens of thousands of children from their families. They became known as the Stolen Generations, victims of a policy of forced assimilation that ended in the 1960s. Most welcomed the official apology, but many continued to demand compensation for their suffering. Muriel Bamblett is from the Victorian Aboriginal Childcare Agency, an organisation founded by Aboriginal Australians in Victoria State in the 1970s.
These people are dying, you know, many of them are in their 70s and 80s, you know, and many have gone to their grave without seeing any reparation. It's more about what it means to the individuals, to those people, to get some acknowledgement and recognition of what happened to them and that it was wrong. We had the apology, but nothing else after that.
The apology to the Stolen Generations in February 2008 was made by then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. He believes Indigenous well-being and opportunity has improved in the past decade.
I dispute the proposition there's been little progress. You ask yourself 10 years on, there's a huge number of additional Indigenous babies who no longer die at birth. We have tens of thousands of more Indigenous kids at the age of 4 attending preschool. So what I would say is people should be encouraged, they should be realistic about the fact that there's still a whole lot to be done.
Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of the Australian population. It's estimated they arrived on the Australian continent up to 60,000 years ago. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. A very popular singing group is about to reunite and go on tour. VOA 1 Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and VOA's Jim Stevenson get ready for old fans and a new generation to spice up their live music enjoyment.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want.
Say what goes around comes around, and in this case that would be a positive thing.
Yes.
Get ready to turn back the clock 20 years because the Spice Girls are one step closer to reuniting and touring. Now, TMZ reports that the five original members, there's Mel B, Scary Spice, mm-hmm. Mel C, Sporty Spice, Emma Bunton, Baby Spice, Jerry Horner, Ginger Spice, and Victoria Beckham, Posh Spice, have all signed off on plans for a reunion tour. TMZ says that last Friday, Mel B signed the contract, which calls for a full tour. The others followed suit. Now, the contract contained the number of dates and the compensation, neither of which have yet been revealed. The gigs will allegedly only take place in the United Kingdom and the United States, and there aren't going to be that many of them. The women will reportedly pocket $14 million apiece from the tour.
That's incentive to get back together.
It sure is, isn't it? The whole thing was masterminded by their former manager, Simon Fuller, who, of course, was also the mastermind behind American Idol. Now, Jerry left the Spice Girls 20 years ago, in 1998, at the very height of their popularity. They haven't released a studio album in 18 years. They toured together in 2007, and they last performed together at the closing ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics. They were supposed to go out on a 20th anniversary tour in 2016, but that was scuttled due to Mel C and Victoria refusing to participate. Mm. This time, everybody's on board, and right now it's looking like a done deal.
And presumably there's a lot more chances for distribution this time around, because 20 years ago things were a little bit different.
Absolutely.
Now you can put out all the videos and all the streaming stuff and all the
pay-per-view, name it. From what we understand, there will not be any new music. There will not be an album coming out of this. It's going to be a greatest hits tour. But I think for the legion of Spice Girl fans worldwide, that'll probably be enough.
Something tells me there might be a live compilation out of this thing.
Oh, you think so? You're an astute man, Jim Stevenson.
Well, you're always on top of things, because each and every week you give us the top 20 countdown. Maybe the Spice Girls will get back in. Who knows? Check out Ray.
Anything's possible.
Anything's possible. And VOA1 is the place to find it. Also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
The Spice Girls brings us to the end of the show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. If you want to be my lover.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of February, Americans celebrate President's Day, when Americans honor all their national leaders, past and present. The day was originally meant to honor the first president and arguably the country's most influential founder, George Washington, who was born on February 22, 1732. The date became an annual, unofficial day of remembrance in the year 1800, the year after President Washington died. It finally became a federal holiday in 1885. Since then, about half the states have modified the observance to include the celebration of another president. On this day, about half the U.S. states also commemorate the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. It is a fitting choice. Born on February 12, 1809, Lincoln, like Washington, was enormously influential in the foundation and development of the United States. Washington led the rebel army that won the country's independence from the British crown, put the nation on a sound financial footing, and led the young United States of America through the initial labor pains that quickly gave birth to a stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, and by ensuring the peaceful transfer of power to the leader elected to succeed him, George Washington set an important precedent for all future presidents. Lincoln, on the other hand, was the glue that held together a country torn by a vicious civil war and set the stage for a peacetime shift in power distribution between federal and state government entities. Ultimately, his actions turned a loose federation of states united under a weak central government into a true union headed by a strong federal government. This change began with slavery laws. Prior to the Civil War, some states allowed slavery by law. Others outlawed slavery. On January 1, 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, abolishing slavery in the rebellious states. This led to the passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery nationwide. We honor Presidents Washington and Lincoln because they embodied the values and character that ennobles public service. On President's Day, we honor presidents past and present as they continue to uphold their oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.